of Malachim Aleph. I mentioned in passing, I mentioned it in the letter to on the bulletin boards, but I know not everybody sees it, but it's worth just bringing up the issue, and this way if anybody has questions, they feel free to ask. Malachim, there is no such thing as Malachim Aleph and Malachim Bet. It's not real. It's a Christian division, which is very old, dating back to probably Jerome, you know, in the fifth century of the Common Era. Jerome was a translator of the Hebrew Bible into Latin, what we call the Vulgate. He was also known as Hieronymus, so you may recognize the name that way. I don't know if it dates back that far, but I do know that there's no such thing as Malachim Aleph and Malachim Bet. In fact, the preferred Christian breakdown is to divide, essentially, there's Kings 1, 2, 3, and 4, starting with Sefer Shmuel. And the way they see it, that the King David, the question is, why is King David not in the Book of Kings if he's a king? So something we actually discussed a little bit, probably at the very early outset, what makes Kings distinct from the book before it, which is Sefer Shmuel. So I'm not, I think it's probably not appropriate to go into again, but I just want you to know that the division is, as best I could tell, arbitrary. If there's some reason to divide it where it is, and I'm going to show you it divides right in the middle of the king's life, then I don't know, your guess is as good as mine. Sometimes these things were done so that the first pasuk would be dramatic. They were preachers many times, and they wanted to make the first verse of any chapter or book dramatic, so that could affect their choices. But here, we'll just do it together, and we'll see whether we could perceive any recognizable change. I can't. I mean, I come up with a few reasons, but nothing that's viable. So, we're on verse 41, Mem Aleph of Perachaf Bet, and that gives us 13 psukim for the end of the book, which will go fairly fast. The camera switches to the south. Yehoshaphat runs away. The camera switches to the south. We're now looking at the southern king, which is rare in the Book of Kings, as long as there are northern kings around. As I mentioned before, the focus of the Book of Malachim is on the northern kings. It focuses on the sins and the troubles of Israel, as opposed to Yehuda. And here, you can see a really good example of it. So let's read the life of Yehoshaphat. You wouldn't know he did anything from the text which shows up here. There's an extra... V'Yoshaphat ben Asa Malach al Yehuda b'shnat arba l'achav melech Yisrael. So you can see they're ruling essentially at the same time. V'Yoshaphat ben 35 shana b'mocho v'25 shana malach b'Yushalayim. So he ruled for 25 years, which isn't bad. In fact, it's 3 years longer than Achav. It's a good reign, 25 years. He made it until he was 60 years old. V'shem imo azuva bat shalchi. It's very common to give the mother's name of the kings, and the reason why that is, and I think not only the Yehuda kings, but certainly the Yehuda kings, because as I mentioned before, the job of Queen Mum, or what was called the Gevira, is a significant position, and her name is significantly displayed. But he did all good; he never stopped doing good, which is a really nice evaluation. We could take a breather, like, whoosh, I haven't seen that in a long time. Achabamot lo saru, orayom zabchim katrim bamot. But decentralized worship still exists. That is, people can come to Yerushalayim if they want to, but they can set up their own little shuls in their backyards, and they could do worship there, which was aser. The Nevi'im didn't like it, but it was in no way avodah zarah, nor was it even an inappropriate worship. It was in an inappropriate place. I was just thinking about the bulletin board. There was some recent comments about making a minion by the restaurants, and it got the usual responses, so I wouldn't want to compare that to this, but I guess just fresh in my mind. So at that time, I don't know if centralized worship is necessary today, but back then the prophets felt that once Yerushalayim went up, it was important for everybody to come to Yerushalayim. Memhei, 45. Vayashleim Yehoshaphati Melech Yisrael. And Yehoshaphat makes peace with the king of Israel. And that's all we hear. That's it. Period. That's all we know. The Yeter Devrei Yehoshaphat Ugvarato Asher Asa Asher Unucham Asher Elohim Tuvim Al Sefer Devrei Yamim Achei Yehuda. And everything else he did are written on the Book of Chronicles. That's not our Devrei Yamim. That's their Devrei Yamim, which is long lost. That's it. That's essentially it. Now, we're going to get a little bit more religious stuff coming up, but essentially, everything he did is summed up in exactly two sentences. He made peace with the North, and everything else you could go look up for yourself. That's not a heck of a lot of a territory for a king that ruled 25 years, and a king who is righteous, to say the least. That's just, however, typical of Sefer Melachim. Melachim is simply not interested in the southern kings. For a very simple reason, the prophets aren't that interested to tell you what you're doing right. They're more interested in telling you what you're doing wrong. But also, it's a northern book written by northern scribes. Chances are that Elisha is writing this, because as I mentioned, we'll find out in the next few chapters, Elisha never calls Ahab by his name, ever. It's just a pattern of Elisha. He won't refer to him, he won't call him by his name, he won't call any northern king of Israel by the name, he just calls him Melech Yisrael, probably as an indication that he didn't really think that they were ruling justly. But I'll continue on. And now we have a little backtrack. The Yeter HaKadesh Asher Nishar Bimei Asav, Yibier Min Aretz. So he got rid of, he burnt away from the land, or he destroyed from the land, the remaining Kadesh. Kadesh, I don't want to get into it in two details, but it's quite clear from the Torah and other places, you're talking about holy prostitution. What they would do is women and men would, I don't know if holy is the appropriate word, a sacral prostitution may be a better word. That is, as part of the process, as part of the pulchan, the procedure that was going on in the temples, not in the temple, but in the side temples, they would have these women set up and men set up, and they would do that was part of what they did. They would represent the gods, sort of like an evil nun, or an anti-nun, if you will. I mean, I'm sure I'd describe it. But essentially, you would come and sleep with her, and that would be you were sleeping with the priestess of the god, and somehow the kids would be sanctified through that union. So this was a popular idea. It still exists. Sexuality and paganism have always gone hand in hand for reasons which are also outside the scope, having to do with the paganism loves the supernatural, the beyond god powers, the force of nature rising up and allowing man to take control of his surroundings. It's one of the sort of like the calling cards of paganism, and sexuality allows people to feel that they're really empowering. They are empowering the whole creation process. It allows a certain amount of a person to feel that they are taking part in the whole God thing. Anyway, let me continue on. Umelech ein be'edom. There was no king in Edom. Nitzav melech. Hard to say what this pasuk means. There was no king in Edom. There was a representative, Nitzav, somebody who stands in for the king. The impression is that Yehoshaphat is well controlled of Edom territory. That's the impression. That is, Edom, really, it was since David's time. David sent up, David really wiped out Edom, going back to Shmuel Bet. And then there was a kind of a remasker. Apparently, the Edomites wiped out one of the army bases in Edom. David had Yoav, that was his general's name, right? Am I getting that right? Yoav go in and he, you know, decimated, you know, who knows how many people. People do not like when their embassies are taken out, so he had great retribution. And essentially, Edom at this time was subservient to Israel. This is simply a positive evaluation, not to Israel, to Yehuda. And we'll find that Edom fights on the side of Yehuda at a later point in time. Yeah. Did you have a question? Oh, okay.
Didn't he have to defend against an attack by Edom?
Not Edom, Ammon and Moab. We're going to get to it. Ammon and Moab.
Where is Edom geographically?
Edom would be in the Jordan Valley, essentially south of the Dead Sea. So essentially there's that flatland south of the Dead Sea. We think of it now as Israel, really, but it wasn't back then. It was Edom. In fact, we've dug up various altars and whatnot, which are definitely Edomite altars. So they definitely...
The city Petra, was Edomite?
Well, Petra was certainly Edomite. It was on the other side of the Jordan River. What I'm saying is they even had stuff on our side of the Jordan River. That is, they were on both. What? That's correct, down to Eilat. But Israel was in control of Eilat going back to Shlomo's time. What?
At Yom Gavir, Eilat. That was very important to hold... geographically.
That's correct. And the Jews, in fact, did hold it geographically, sort of. We're about to get to that right now. It's a touchy place. David conquered it originally. Shlomo made a deal with the Lebanese king named Hiram, and they sent ships from that area. The reason why it's so important, and we're going to get to it now, so I'll take a little time to do it. Keep in mind that Yamsuf, there are two Yamsufs. Yamsuf is the Red Sea, and then it splits off like rabbit ears on both sides of the Sinai Peninsula. On the eastern side of the Sinai Peninsula. That's the Gulf of Aqaba that comes up into Aqaba and Eilat. On the other side is the side that the Jews crossed when they were crossing the desert. That's in between the Sinai Peninsula and Egypt proper. It's what we call the Gulf of Suez, if I'm not mistaken. Am I getting that right? The Gulf of Suez. But essentially, according to the Torah, it's all Yam Suf. You have to be careful when you're reading the Torah, because when it says that they went to Yam Suf, there are two possibilities there, and you sort of have to know which way you are traveling. In any event, Edom is crucial because it's the only way to get ships down to the African and Arabian Peninsula. So if you think about it, I'm sorry, I should have brought a map probably. I don't think I have a map here. But if you think about it, so you have, the whole Africa is this way, right? So you have this big sort of like teardrop shape. And then you have the Red Sea, and on the other side of the Red Sea you have the Arabian Peninsula. That would be southern Saudi Arabia, Yemen, that area. And then if you go around, you essentially could go to India, or you could go up to the Iraq and to Iran. The only way to get to the coast of Africa which is on the inside, is to go down through Eilat. Otherwise, you have to circumnavigate all of Africa. There's just no way around. And keep in mind, there was no Suez Canal at the time, so you weren't going that way. The only way to do it would be to go to Eilat, set up ships, and sail from there. And that's exactly what they did. That's what Shlomo did. And based on that they could plunder then the African and Arabian border countries. And that's essentially what was going on.
Plunder or trade?
Well, trade is a funny word. It depends on who's got the upper hand. I would say plunder probably. Yeah, it was imperialist. It was imperialist.
But you don't mean pirate. You mean plunder.
What? Plunder. That is, they would go to these countries like Eritrea, what is now Eritrea, Sudan. And if Egypt, depending on how far Egypt's power went, I mean, Egypt's power could go pretty far south, but in times of Egyptian weakness, essentially you had very little people living on very little land, and a lot of gold, so what they would do is they'd go and they would take the gold away from that country. That's simply what they did. I don't want to apologize for it, it's simply the way that people did business back then. Imperialism used to be a good thing. It went out of style, I don't know, about 250 years ago or so.
Naturally, so that you need food, you got wheat. You have a lot of gold. You know, it used to be five coins for this. Now it's 20 coins.
Maybe. I think they probably put the people to work and they got the gold out. That's my sense of things. The Torah doesn't seem to take a negative standpoint against imperialism. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it does. And it could be all the gold corrupted Shlomo. There will be no gold coming here by Yehoshaphat, so we really don't know. It's hard to say. There's no direct prophetic evaluation of whether plundering or imperialism, I should say, is a good thing or a bad thing.
Was Edom also important because of its... key positions on Derech HaMelech?
Yeah, I think so. The fact that it was all the flatlands, essentially. Big mountains to the left of it, big mountains to the right of it, if you're looking north, to the east and west. I think it's a very rich, it was a very rich land, really. It was certainly salty and dry, but comparatively, it was probably the only place to live down there until you got all the way down to Etzion Gavre. I mean, there's really nothing there. Even today, it's hard to live down there. You have a few places, and it's Beri Mon. You have where David Ben-Gurion lived, what was the name of that place?
Stay Boker.
But there's not a lot going on, and that's with irrigation and all kinds of things. Anyway, I'm going to I'll continue on. Nemt had something very strange that happens. Yoshafat asa oniot Tarshish. So he made these great ships. Tarshish is a very difficult word, but let's just assume big seafaring ships. Lalechet ofira lazahav, to go down to Ophir to take gold. V'lohalach, he couldn't go because the ships broke. That's all the Navi's going to tell us. He's not going to tell us how it broke. Something very, very fishy. You know, it's like one of those stories that you really want to sit down and get the story behind the story, but we simply, as far as that is, the details of how they broke. I mean, does that mean that they fell apart? They didn't have technology? Were they attacked? I don't believe we get that information even in Divrei Yamin. Let's continue on. Azamar l'achatziyahu ben achav el Yoshafat. Now here there's a little jump in space. So he said to the current king, who was Ahaziyahu ben Achav, I'm sorry, I apologize, I got it backwards. Az amar Ahaziyahu ben Achav el Yoshafat, yelchu avadayim avadecha boniyot velo avad Yehoshafat. Now I got to give you a little background here. Who is Ahaziyah? We haven't met him yet. You see how strange this little insertion is? This whole insertion of Yehoshafat, you can sort of tell, is inserted later into the Book of Kings, which came completely from the north. Because we haven't met a Chazi yet. We're not going to meet a Chazi until Pasuk Nun Bet. You see what I'm saying? But they wanted to point out, I suppose, because really Yehoshaphat was not really co-ruling with Ahaziah, who was Ahab's son. He was really co-ruling with Yehoshaphat, Ahab. So when Ahab dies, they want to give you the picture of Yehoshaphat as well, even though Yehoshaphat outlives Ahab and really is dealing with his son at this point.
Well, we were introduced to him already.
Were we?
Yeah. Back in Mem.
Oh, you were exactly right. Mem. I apologize. So there's no proof about an insertion of text. I could not. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. Okay. So Ahaziah wants to make a deal with Yehoshaphat, and Yehoshaphat says, no way. Lo avah Yehoshaphat. Now, here's something very interesting. What we're going to find out in Divrei Hayamim when we do it, which is not this week, because I want to stay focused on the north for right now, is the Navi comes and says, because you made a peace treaty, remember that one little line, you made a peace treaty? So in Divrei Hayamim, they're going to give him a long castigation about how dare he make a peace treaty with Ahab, don't you know the guy's a sinner, etc., 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 and because of that, your ship's broken at Tzion Gafet. So according to the Mefarshim, because Yehoshaphat is a frum guy, he listened to his prophets, he got punished, and then when Ahaziah wants to continue the relationship and rebuild the ships to go take take the gold one way or another, so he doesn't do it because he's a very frum guy. It's certainly possible. We don't know that, but what we do know is Ahaziah was no Ahab. You see what I'm saying? When Ahab said, do you want to come with me to go to war, if you remember, Yehoshaphat's statement was, my nation is your nation, my troops are your troops, my horses are your horses. There was really subservience to the northern cause. Not only is there no subservience here to the northern cause, Yehoshaphat don't think much of Ahaziah, and he's not going to make any partnership with him whatsoever. You could say this is religious. We don't get that impression here. Divrei Hayamim will give us that impression. All we have here is Ahaziah was, I knew Ahab and you're no Ahab. Ahaziah is not Ahab and Yehoshaphat is not going to play along with him. His son Yehoram takes over. So essentially, for probably one of the more significant kings of Yehuda, you get 12 psukim, almost no information whatsoever, barely any prophecy about whether he's doing good or bad, nothing. It's just flat vanilla. They just want to give you a sense of who he was, and now they're going to go to Ahaziah. Now, there's a tremendous amount of material in Divrei Hayamim. Tremendous amount. It's impossible completely to understand what's going on without looking at Divrei Hayamim, and we're going to do that next week. But I want to attack Ahaziah, so to speak, literally maybe and figuratively. I want to attack Ahaziah this week, but next week we're going to take a look at Yehoshaphat. However, the one thing I can tell you is Yehoshaphat, for all that we could say by Mefarshim, that Yehoshaphat wouldn't have anything to do with the north, the bottom line is he's intermarried with the north. His son is named the same as the ruler that will come up after Ahaziah, that is Yehoram, and he will outlive Yehoram also. Yehoram's going to make it 2 years and die. Sorry. Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, is going to make it 2 years and die, which means, and since Yehoshaphat outlives Ahab by 7 years, that means he lives to see Yehoram. He lives to see Yehoram.
All right, what year are we? How many years since the country was divided?
All right, so we are roughly 60s, 100 years afterwards, maybe a little less, about 90 to 100 years. Yeah, this is a real attempt at reunification. And what we don't see here is that Yehoshaphat attempts reunification. That's not put into this book by and large. We're going to see that all of that attempt at reunification, Yehoram is intermarried into the family, there are two Yehorams ruling at the same time, one in the north, one in the south. All of those attempts are going to be seen, that is, the evaluation of how good of a king Yehoshaphat was, is simply not the topic here. We're simply really not interested. We give the bare facts, let's get the guy out there, get the information, and let's move on. The reason why Edom is mentioned is because Edom is going to come into play at a later time, because it's going to be critical to the northern kings. And even the issue with building the ships is critical because it involves Ahaziah, the northern king. So really, we've got to put Yehoshaphat on hold. I just want to sort of foreshadow the idea that there's a lot more interplay, and Yehoshaphat is still continuing to attempt unification, which is important for what's coming up. And now let's get to Ahaziah.
Do you have any implication that Ahab was also trying to bring unification?
Yeah. He brings Yehoshaphat up. They sit and they do this joint rule with Ahab sort of sitting a little bit higher than. They both want it. They both want it. Who wouldn't want it? Who would not want reunification of the state of Israel? Nobody wouldn't. Nobody wouldn't want it now. Nobody wouldn't want it then.
If they had to unify, one of them obviously would be
the Ahab was the superior one, and apparently Yehoshaphat was willing to go along with it. Yehoshaphat was willing to go along with it. Hence the problem. That's where the prophets are going to beat up on him in Divrei Hayamim. That's exactly what they can do. But here, it's just not. It's not a problem because it doesn't. His actions do not affect the fall of the temple. That's what Yirmiyahu is concerned about. Yirmiyahu is editing this sefer, is concerned about the fall of the temple. So at the time, you probably thought the biggest thing in the world was Yehoshaphat's attempt to reunify with Ahab. And let's talk about Yehoshaphat. Yirmiyahu thinks he's a blip on the history is written by the historian. There's really no such thing as history. It's historiography. How does the historian write his history to make the point he's trying to make? And the point that's being made here is Yehoshaphat is the tiniest of blip on the issue of why the temple fell. And that's really what's going on here. Well, I'll continue on to the bigger blips, which are Ahaziahu. Ahaziahu ben Ahav, malach al Yisrael b'shomron b'shnat shvashrei Yehoshaphat melech Yehuda. He ruled in the 17th year. That doesn't exactly work out with the years, but the years usually slide by one or two. Vayimloch ha'Yisrael shnatayim. He makes it 2 years. Vayasara b'nei Hashem, vayelech v'derech aviv, v'derech imo, v'derech yiravam ben nevat, asher chvi Yisrael. He's got three sins. Count them three. He's got his father's sin, that's Baal. He's got Yisrael's sins. Who knows what Yisrael is doing up to? She's murdering people right and left. She worships Baal. She worships the Asherah, the goddess Asherah, not just the tree Asherah. And let's not forget Yeravam ben Nevat, who is the idols. He's got it all. You want to sin? Ahaziahu's got it for you. Asherah the Israel. Nun Dalet, 54. Vayavod et Baal vayishtachav Elo. He serves the Baal, and he bows down to him. Vayachesed Adonai Elohi Yisrael kol asher asah aviv. He's just like his father. Vayivsham Moav b'Yisrael acharei mot Ahav. After Ahav dies, Moab commits sins. That's a bad translation. I'll explain why I'm translating like that in a second. Vayifsha Moab Yisrael acharei mot Ahav. And by the way, I don't know if anybody noticed, we're now in Malachim Bet Pasuk Aleph. Why? I couldn't tell you. I mean, I don't know. Maybe because we're talking about Moab, but I mean, who cares? If we were talking about Edom, we didn't start a new Torah. Now, the word vayifsha here is very, very interesting and worth some attention because it helps us understand our tefillot. What does the English do with Vayivsha, the very first word in Malachim Bet, verse Aleph? Oh my goodness, I forgot to record. Ooh, sorry, Arnie. Okay. how does the English deal with Vayivsha?
Rebel.
That's a good word. I'm not crazy about it exactly, and I'll tell you why, although it's certainly... Well, you know what? It is a good word. We have another one? Got it. What's in your English there with... The translation of Vayivsha.
Right.
What?
Same word.
Okay. So first of all, the word poshea, of course. I mean, we tend to categorize. We have like 100 different words for sin, and we tend to all glom them together. But here, the word pasha is very good. It is used for a vassal that decides no longer to be a vassal. The implication here: a vassal is somebody who has their own country and remains their own country. This is not a district or a holding. We let Moab be. They get to call themselves Moab. Too much trouble to take over the whole country. Lord knows it's hard to cover a whole country into your territory. What they have to do is pay a yearly tax, which is tremendous, which is very high in terms of money and people. When one stops paying that tax, that's Vayivsha. I think that's interesting when we look at the word Poshea in our own prayers, to think about exactly how that word, how those two things relate. A lot of times it's hard to get.
The same structure that Judea had to do with Rome.
What's that?
They were left alone, but then
when they started paying, that's correct, just Judea. That's exactly right. It's called a vassalage.
The four kings and five kings during Abraham's time.
That's correct. And they also, if Shabbo, that means they stopped paying taxes. Exactly right. That's precisely what it means. They stopped paying taxes for 12 years. It was in the 13th year. Sorry. They stopped. 13 or 14, I can't remember. I think they stopped paying taxes for 13 years, that means in the 14th year they've had enough and they made them pay back taxes in spades. Apparently there was some type of matting. What happened was they had these aliyot, these attics, which were cooler. They went up there because they were simply cooler. And the floor was probably open, like in a boat, so to speak, probably covered with some type of ironwork or stonework. And apparently he went right through. It was like one of those comedy things where the guy walks over a, like those sad stories where the guy is, like, walks right into a trap door, essentially, without noticing where he's going. So Achaziah is a klutz. He walks in, Hashem Shalom, Vayachal, he gets sick. Vayishlach malachim, Vayomer lehem, Lechu dirshu b'val zvuv, Elohei Ekron, Im echiemi chol izet. So he goes to Baal Zvuv, who's probably one and the same as the Baal himself. He says, I want to know, I'm going to do what's called an oracle. I want an oracle, am I going to survive? The word dirshu, as I mentioned before, but I will say it again, I'm sorry, I'm doing a lot of mention before, the word dirshu is not a positive word in Sefer Melachim. The idea of an oracle is not taking well in Sefer Melachim. Ezra likes the idea of oracles a little bit better, but Sefer Melachim, it's usually used with a negative context. I want to stop here for a second before we get to Eliyahu Tishbi, who gets called back into service, and I'd like to pass these out to you. And then, I'm sorry, I didn't print enough. We actually have a kind of a full crowd. I'll just keep the book, and I'll read out of the book, although the text may not be a little bit, this text is a little bit better. This is called the Moabite stone that you're looking at. The top right-hand side is a reproduction. It's not very accurate. The actual stone looks like this. It is in the Louvre. It is currently in the Louvre. I do not believe it's an original, by the way. I believe that somebody was smart enough to take a plaster of the original, one of those during the great heydays of the English when they were all over the Middle East, the days of Lawrence of Arabia and that period of time. And I think they were smart enough to take a plaster cast of it. By the time they got back to make a purchase, it had been destroyed into little tiny pieces because it happened. The same thing happened with the Dead Sea Scrolls because you get more money per piece. You follow? Now, with scrolls, literally, that's what they did. They made little tiny pieces because each one sold for a higher price. They made more money. The problem is they destroyed the humongous amount of scrolls in the effort. That's just the way it worked. What they did was they completely destroyed the Moabite stone. I think there wasn't much putting it together, but fortunately a plaster was made. Why is it black? I think what they did is they found another black stone and they sort of recarved based on the plaster mold. I could be wrong about this. Maybe it is the original, but I seem to remember reading that it's not the original. They had to recast it because it was destroyed by people trying to make money. You should, what?
Small fortune.
Yeah, small fortune. I mean, they made it. I doubt back in the 1800s they made a fortune. I'm not sure. Well, with this, they probably knew what they had. It's such a distinct. It's a large stone. I mean, this is a fairly large stone. It is. I'll tell you how large it is. No, unfortunately, it doesn't have this information. I think it's a fairly large stone, larger than the usual inscription. You can see from the writing, by the way, this is Proto-Hebrew. This is what's called your Phoenician script, which is very close to the old Hebrew. Whether the Torah was written in this script or not is, of course, a machloket. We paskin that the Torah was written in Ketav Ashurit, which is the Hebrew that you have in front of you. However, it is a machlok.
No.
What?
No, it was in Hebrew.
No, it's
Ashurit came much later.
You're asking me how the Gemara paskins or what the reality was. The Pesach in the Gemara comes out with the conclusion that it was written that the original language was Ashurit. It was switched to Ivri, which is really a Phoenician script at a later time during the kings, and then they switched it back to Ashurit. I'm not an expert on scribal activity. I can't tell you whether Ketav Ashuri is a very old language. Aramaic is a very, very old language. But what the script looked like, I don't know. All I can tell you is in the time of the kings, it looked like this. The Gemara does have a machloket. It paskins one way, but again, it's not one of those things that I say it paskins that the Torah was actually written in Ketav Ashuri, that is the block script. If you remember the famous medrash about how the mem stood in, because the mem is all circled, so it's surrounded and should fall out of the text, but a miracle happened staying in the text. All that's based on the idea that the Torah was written in Ketav Ashuri. Do you understand what I mean? That is, if this mem here is chiseled into the text, then the middle would fall out. You know what I'm saying? You wouldn't have a mem. The whole thing, like a donut. You eat around the donut, you got nothing left. Not the hole in the middle and not the donut either. It just falls right out of the wall. So, or if I say if you chisel around the donut. So, we posken that way, but we're not talking about Pat Kalocha. You're not a... I don't think, I mean, I'm sure some people might say it, but I don't think anybody is blasphemous. It's not one of the animamim's. Nowhere does Rambam say that animamim ben muna shlema, that the Torah was written in Ketav Asherim, not Ketav Ifrit. What is the probability? I think the probability is exactly what Anne said. It was probably written in Ketav Asherim and it was changed at a later time. Sorry, Ketav Ivri, which is this Phoenician script that you're looking at.
And I think the Mem is different in Ketav Ivri, or the Samach is, so that's not a problem.
Oh, does that how it works out? That's interesting. I'm curious to take a look. There are some rounded letters here also, letters that would also give you problems. That's true. In any event, so this is what it looks like. It's pretty cool. You can read it with a decent amount of work. Most of the letters, an Aleph will become an, the Aleph will become an Aleph will become an A. A lot of these letters are easily determined by, if you really pay attention, you'll see how they later formed into Greek letters. And essentially what we have is propaganda, but by the other side. So I'd like to read it to you. I am Mesha, son of Chemosh, king of Moab. Again, I keep saying the things that I've talked about in this class, and that's another one of those things that I've mentioned here, but I'd like to repeat. In my opinion, Chemosh is the same as Moloch. One was the king of Moab, one was king of Ammon, but they interchange. They're the same guy. As far as I can tell from Tanakh, this is monotheism. They did not, as far as I can tell, Moab and Ammon did not have multiple gods. They had one god. The wrong one, but one god. The god who was doing the wrong things, as we'll see, because there's human sacrifice coming up, but certainly a single god. That's not enough to call it monotheism, but one certainly gets that sense from Tanakh. When I read this, I think it just becomes more obvious. I'm not an expert on these things. Maybe they did worship multiple gods, but I believe they worshiped just Chemosh. I am Mesh, the son of Chemosh, king of Moab, the Debonite. My father had reigned over Moab for 30 years, and I reigned after my father. I apologize if my text is a little bit different than yours. Who made this high place, that would be a Bama, for Chemosh in Karcho. Because he saved me from all the kings and caused me to triumph for all the adversaries. And now we get to history. As for Omri, Omri is Ahab's father, king of Israel, he humbled Moab many years. And by the way, you can see it's literally days, the Yamim Rabim, that means years. For Chemosh was angry at his land. That is, why were the Moabites losing? Because their god was angry at them, hence the punishment. This is our belief as well. It's not far from our belief. Keep in mind that Ammon and Moab are both Abrahamic descendants, and there's a reason to assume that there's a common belief there. It gives you a sense. I don't think it takes anything away from Judaism, but it does imply that exclusivity, nothing happens in a vacuum. People affect each other, and certainly Ammon and Moab were affected by Jewish rule, and they felt the way they did. Just they were on the other side of the, they were like the Russians versus the Americans. Who's right? I guess it depends on who you ask. In this case maybe it's more obvious, but in some cases if you ask a Palestinian, sometimes I think it shocks us. You see Palestinians talking about the justice of the cause, and it shocks us. I mean, don't they read the papers that we read? But they feel very strongly about their cause, and this is a sense of this. Was angry at his land, and his son followed him, that would be Ahab, and he also said, I will humble Moab. In my time he spoke thus, but I have triumphed over him and over his house. Not Yehoshaphat, this would be Ahab. But he say, I triumphed over him, that would be Ahab. Where does Ahaziah come in here?
Over his house.
Over his house, exactly right, Bito. Beta, right? So the bayit of the melech, ma'aselach habayit, that would be Ahaziah. So essentially he's admitting that when Ahaziah came to power, he tried maybe put a little few dents into Ahav, but when Ahaziah came to power, goodbye, good luck. Yehoshaphat knew a loser when he saw one, and so did Moab. They knew a loser when they saw one. Now Omri had occupied the land of Medbah. This is Medbah, the same one that shows up in the Torah. In Israel had dwelt there in his time, and half the time of his son Ahab, 40 years, but Chemosh dwelt there in my time, which means it ain't no more Jewish territory. Now, we don't get all that from that one little sentence in our Torah. The Navi is not interested in telling us the destruction of Medbah, but he is. You have to read in between the lines. All it says, Vayefsha Moab Yisrael Acharei Mot Ahab. So if you read the Torah simplistically, it's not simplistically, it's like they stopped sending the checks. Ahaziah had a tantrum and said, they won't send me the test, and that was the end of it. That's not what happens. There's a lot summed up in a single pasuk, and here is one of those cases we're actually getting what's on the other side of the coin. And I built Baal Ma'on, and making a reservoir in it, and I built Kiryat Tayim. You should recognize that. That's a city that the five kings, when they came to battle the five kings, they stopped in. Now the men of Gad, and look at this, these are the actual tribal names, Gad being on the other side of the Jordan River, right, the two and a half tribes, Gad, Reuven, Gad, and Chatzishe Rasheh, had always dwelt in the land of Atarot, which is exactly what our Tanakh says, and the king of Israel had built Atarot for them. But I fought against the town and took it and slew all the people of the town as satiation for Chemosh and Moab. He destroyed everybody in it. Now, we've done that once in Yericho, maybe, maybe not. But here, this is whether this is hyperbole or whether this hyperbolic or hyperbole or whether this is real, I couldn't tell you. But it is a massacre and a loss of God from this land of Moab. And I brought back from there Uriel, its chieftain, dragging him before Chemosh in Kiriot. We never hear about Uriel in Artanath. And I settled there men of Sharon, I don't think that's us, and men of Maharif, that's not us. And Chemosh said to me, now go take Nebo, as in Har Nebo, where Moshe died. Go take Nebo from Israel. So I went by night and fought against it from the break of dawn until noon, which means it was a tough battle, taking it and slaying all 7,000 men, boys, women, girls, maidservants, for I devoted them to destruction for the gods Ashtar Chemosh. Ashtar probably means Ishtar also, which means there's a Babylonian influence already on their worship. And I took from there the something of Hashem, there must have been some kind of altar there, dragging them before Chemosh, and the king of Israel had built Yachatz, which we also have, that's Yatza, remember that? The city that Moshe sent spies against, the city of Yatza, that shows up in the Midbar. And he dwelt there while he was fighting with me, but Chemosh drove him out drove him out before me, that's a Chaziyahu, he ran away. And I took Moab, 200 men, all first-class warriors, and set them against Yachza, and took him in order to attach the district of Dibon. It was I who built, etc., etc., etc. He tells himself all the things that he builds. I cut beams for Karo with Israelite captives. I built Aror Er, that's the famous Aror Er in the Torah. I built Baal Bamot, for it had been destroyed. I built Betzer, Betzer is also in our Torah, etc., etc., etc.
Rebuilt,
that's exactly right. I don't know what to say. It's a brutal loss for Israel. Of course, Chazal note the fact that Reuven, Gad, Chatzi, Shem, and Asher simply disappear from Sefer. They disappear from Sefer Malachim. So Chazal say that they were the first ones to be exiled because they didn't want to move in Israel. But we never really find out exactly when they're exiled. Now we know, only in the last 100 years. Now, this is a bombshell 100 years ago. None of us doubts for a minute that when the Jews say, it says in the Torah, that they conquered Yatza, and they conquered Nebo, and they conquered Atarot and Dibon, no one here really doubts that. We just assume that the Torah has accurate information. Are we afraid that maybe they didn't live there? How could they have lived there? So I got to tell you that outside the more religiously dedicated world, people doubted all these facts. So I have to tell you, when they found this stone, it was a bombshell. Today, if they found this stone, you know exactly what would happen with the stone. What would happen to the stone if they found this today?
Make a movie out of it.
No. Now, what happens to every piece of new archaeology that somebody finds?
It's a forgery.
Mm-hmm. Forgery. Unless an archaeologist finds it when he's digging. An archaeologist did not find this stone, nor did they find. An archaeologist did not find the Dead Sea Scrolls. An archaeologist does not find the famous letters of Tel al-Amarna. Archaeologists find very little that the Bedouins and other people living have not already found themselves. Or when an archaeologist gets there and makes a discovery, they quickly, when they go to sleep for the night, a whole bunch of people move in and they take all the stuff out and then they sell it on a secondary market where they could actually make some money. Today the stone would simply be called a forgery and nobody would believe a single word of it. But at the time... It was found accidentally. It was found. There were archaeologists at the time, but they were looking for stuff. And I believe that the locals said, "We have something to show you." The archaeologist came and said, "Wow, that's a deal." Today, the archaeologist would come and say, "That's a forgery." I don't think there's a single find in the last 10 years, if I'm not mistaken, that has not been considered a forgery. The Yehoash document, the new pomegranate, that famous pomegranate, which is in the Israel Museum, all of it is considered forgery. And now essentially you have nothing to base non-forgeries against. If everything's a forgery, then what's your statistical mean? So, be it as it may. But I wanted to show you that don't know, this is a way of identifying, honestly, I don't want to say it's the truth of the Torah, because it also identifies, to my mind, identifies two things. One is the Torah Kedosha has accurate information. But the second thing is it has accurate information as much as it feels like giving you, which is very often not a lot. Very often not a lot. It just couldn't care less. The Navi could not care less. It could not find any spiritual meaning in the fall of Reuben, God save Mashiach. As far as we know, everything that had to be said was said by the time when Moshe told him, what are you doing by not living in Eretz Israel? That's how Chazal interpreted it. For us, what could we do? We got an entire, you know, year of battles, a massacre of probably 20,000, 30,000 Jews. Right? He says he massacred 7,000 men, and that was one city. And he talks about five or six cities that he took. How many people were put to the knife? Or taken, and plus the people who were taken slaves, you're probably talking about 50 to 75,000 people. Reuben and Gad simply pretty much disappear from the map to a large extent, and all they get is one lousy pasuk in Sefer Melachim. It's neither good nor bad. It just means that when you're reading Tanakh, you have to understand that if you're looking for historical accuracy, you're looking for the wrong thing. There is historical accuracy when the Navi wants to use it to make a point. And the Navi will stress certain things and not stress certain other things based on what his goal is, based on what God wanted him to do. That's a very important concept. I thought I was going to get to Eliyahu Navi, but I don't want to go over time. Eliyahu Navi is going to show up. We thought Eliyahu was fired. Eliyahu Navi is going to show up, and the usual massacres will start to take place. Eliyahu will wipe out all kinds of people for being sinners, and then Eliyahu will be called away from the planet completely on a fiery chariot. So we're going to go through the Eliyahu story, essentially, and Ahaziah will be read the riot act. Eliyahu will essentially have, I won't say he'll have a lot of people killed, but people will be killed because they're in Eliyahu's presence, and that's simply just what happens when Eliyahu is around. And then when we're finished with that, we're going to go back to Yehoshaphat and look at Divrei Hayamim, and that's over the course of the next 2 weeks. Please, you had a question?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I don't know, my
sense is that they're trying to make fun of him to a certain extent. I mean, all they would have had to say was that he got sick, right? Especially he was walking in his attic and he fell through a grating in his attic, apparently broke his leg pretty badly or something like that. He could have had internal injuries. But I have to say,
What's the theological significance about this? Perhaps he had said, look, I'll send my expert engineers down the south to help you build your ships, and look at his downfall was that it's logic construction.
I don't want to say that there's a character assassination going on here, but it could be that Yirmiyahu, who were the Nubby at the time, maybe Elisha is choosing like everybody would say, what a loser. Now, that's a modern interpretation of this pasuk, and I have to admit, that's my modern eyes, and we have all kinds of things like irony and sarcasm, although I think you'll find irony and sarcasm in the Torah as well, but maybe not quite as developed as we have it now, thanks to the op-ed pages of the New York Times. So, I don't know if this is an ironic or sarcastic statement, but it could just be calling him a dummy. I mean, honestly, the kind of king that nobody would have anything to do with. He loses Moab, he loses Jehoshaphat, doesn't want anything to do with him. It could just be saying, like a big L on his forehead, and that might be what's going on here.
Maybe
I don't know for sure.
Explaining why he didn't live longer.
Yeah, but it could have
maybe
said, with a lot of other kings, it could easily say that he just got sick. It's a very detailed,
but.
He not only falls down and hurts himself, but it gives us a description of the grating almost, and he was in the attic, and he fell through to the first floor. It is so, I was just busy telling you that the Torah usually leaves out these kind of details, and here we get so much information, it's a little too much. So I have to say, Dr. Boninger, I think that they're making fun of him, and I don't, that's a modern interpretation, but that's the best, with this pasuk, it's the best I got. Yeah. All right, we'll see Eliyahu at his best next week, God willing.
And bring Divrei Hayamim next week?
It's going to take us a full time to get through Eliyahu.
Oh, so I don't need it next week?
I don't think
okay.
so. I think we'll do Yehoshaphat in 2 weeks.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
I just,
have a good night. Thanks for coming.
I don't have a...